So just to give you a glimpse of my professor life, not that you really care, but so yesterday was the deadline for submission to the big computer vision conference. There's every 2 years, the International Conference on Computer Vision happens. And so this year it happened, it's going to happen in Beijing in the fall. And we're going to have this deadline for it. So this, almost all my group was busy submitting papers. The deadline was midnight Greenwich Mean Time, which fortunately translates to reasonable our time, 7 p.m. Yesterday. So we got four papers submitted and total working all the time for it. That was good. And then normally I'm all done, you know, I'm relaxed. But this year I'm the program chair for the conference, so I'm one of the three people who kind of runs the whole thing. So now I get hit on both sides of the deadline, because now I have to look at the 1,230 papers that were submitted to this conference and decide which one should go to which reviewer, which area chair, and then they assign me to review. Anyway, so it's wild. And also you get a real sense for all the exceptions. I mean, just imagine 1,230 people, and everyone has something, you know, oh, they didn't get this done in time. Oh, can they redo the submission because they made some mistakes? And it's just awful. Let's see. And the weird thing, only about 230 are going to get accepted. So it's like the vast majority of the people in our community are going to get a paper rejected from this conference. So it's awful. It's a shame. Let's see. But on to this work. So I want to talk about sort of generative models and probabilistic models for vision. Now, the thing I really want to do is give you a complete semester-long class in machine learning. But I can't really do that. And so then I sort of have to give a sampling of it. And I'm still sort of struggling with how to strike that balance between, you know, teaching fundamental material on machine learning versus sort of teaching applications. So if you can help me with that, like after the class or just in general, send me an email for things that you want more focus on or want less focus on, that would be useful. But so we'll see how this goes. So this part of this is from a tutorial that I gave with Andrew Blake at actually last time's International Conference on Computer Vision on this topic. So let's see, well, what's the goal of vision? Suppose you get this image sequence, which happens to be my son running in first base. If your goal for computer vision is to ask a question like, are there any faces in this image, then the sort of probabilistic model you would use, sort of model you might apply, would be a so-called discriminative method, where all you're trying to do is ask for any given patch of the image, is it a face? And so you don't need to model probabilities directly, you just need to answer this question for every single patch of the picture. And in many ways that's easier than the other issue, which is suppose that instead of asking that question, are there faces, you're asking, find me a three-dimensional model that describes the pose of the runner. So suppose this was the answer you wanted, that was your goal from vision, some skeleton was overlaid on top of the figure. Then you might use a generative model. You might use something where you have a parameterization of the stick figure, and you want to maximize the probability that that parameterization would give you the pose you observed. And so in that case, you might indeed want to use these so-called generative models, which is what we're going to talk about today. And then later on in the class, we'll talk about these discriminative methods, where you're not trying to model some probability distribution. We're just trying to discriminate between face and grass, face and object. And by the way, they're called generative because if you have a probability distribution on this skeleton, you can, and on the image, you can draw samples from, you can generate other data from your model. So here's the approach we're going to take today and Thursday. We're going to look at, so the main goal for this visual task is to take high-dimensional visual data in and fit models to it. So we're going to talk about fitting models to data a little bit. And then we find that for these high-dimensional models, you really can't deal with them directly as a big high-dimensional distribution. And really what you want to do is modularize your probability distribution. So we use these so-called graphical models, which are kind of like tinker toys for modeling. And we'll talk about those a little bit. And then I sort of forgot to pop up one level. Yes, you have a take-home exam that's given to you today. So it's going to be posted on the web at the end of class. And just to review again one more time, the rules are, it's just going to be open web. Good news to everyone. So, but you're, you know, expecting an open seal for software. By opening the seal, you agree to the terms of it. By taking this exam, you're going to play by the rules, and you're not going to talk to other people about it. And that's getting that phone from you is what lets the students do it for an exam. So you've got to play by the rules. And the drawing allows you to do that. And just let us know what you need. And then you have to attend to the sign. Make sure that everyone knows what you're doing. Okay, so back down to the topic. Let's talk about how to fit the model. So let's start with something really simple. A set of 1D samples. So you have your number line, and you can group different positions on the number line sample data. And let's say you can pick between Gaussian probabilities, probability distribution, and you want to find parameters of that. So this is a toy problem, and then the tridimensional problem that that might correspond to would be that you, again, say are kind of juxtaposed with a person who's from data to compare. If you have the data and you have a model from the parameter, and you know how the model makes data, it's really just a very tridimensional version of this type of procedure. So we want to fit this density of points with the Gaussian. And our Gaussian has this form where we think that this data is drawn from something where the probability that it's drawn from any position z is given by e minus z minus the mean squared or 2 sigma squared. So are there kind of knee-jerk reactions to how you would solve this? Like, what's the first thing you would do? Suppose someone gave you a pile of points and you fit it to that, what would you do?
Take the sample.
Okay, right. Yes, and you can sort of work through the reasoning for why that's... So that's because you kind of know this distribution and you know how to play with it. If you had someone where you didn't know it, you might have a more general procedure, and we'll just go through that general procedure for this case where we know what the answer should be. Okay, so we're going to use Bayes' rule. I mean, what we really want to find out is, given these data points you observed, what's the probability that the parameters that generated it have this particular mean mu and standard deviation sigma? So that's what we want to find. And then we might take the mean of this probability or the MAP solution to find these estimates. So again, even though we know that the answer is going to be take the mean and take the sample covariance, we're going to work through how you do it so we can also do that in more general cases where we don't know what the answer should be. So we use Bayes' rule and convert this from condition on the data points to being condition on the parameters we're trying to estimate. So what's the probability, suppose we had a Gaussian distribution with these given parameters, what's the probability that I get any one of the data points, or get the whole data set, times the prior probability for those parameters, and divided by this so-called evidence term. And again, we saw these earlier. This is called a posterior, so it's what you think about the world after you make your measurements, posterior to the measurement. This is called a likelihood function, this is called a prior. And this term, which we can often ignore, is called the evidence. It doesn't, for a given set of samples, it doesn't change when you're meddle with these parameters, so we can often just treat it as a proportionality constant. You can't always do that, but often you can. So if you knew information about what, you know, it might be the case that you know things about what the mean should be, in which case you would put it here. But oftentimes you say, well, I really don't know anything about it, and I'm just going to use so-called maximum likelihood, where I just ignore this term, ignore the prior term, and just look at the likelihood term. So, by the way, where is this going to work well and where is it not going to work well? Well, it's going to work well to use maximum likelihood where the data swamps the prior probabilities. So if you have a lot of data, then it really doesn't matter what you use for your priors. They're going to be swamped by the likely return. Everything else will be set to zero. Things that are... It'll be so highly peaked toward the parameters of interest that you can just get away with looking at this term. But when you have really sparse, very few samples, then it really matters what you do. And in particular for Gaussian, sometimes you can really get in trouble by taking this sort of non-Bayesian approach and just trying to maximize the likelihood if you don't have enough samples. But in this case, we're going to explore the maximum likelihood solution. So that tells us, take this likelihood thing, which sort of asks the reverse question, suppose mu and sigma were my parameters, what's the probability of getting the data I saw? And you just twiddle with mu and sigma until you get something that really, really likes the data that you saw. So now we can go through the math that gives the answer that everybody knows. So this is, and the whole reason of using Bayes' rule is because we know what this probability is. We know we can start from the given parameters and see what the probability of the data is. So that's just the probability that we would have seen the data under this particular Gaussian distribution. And now to make the math easier, you often work in the log domain. So we'll take the logarithm of that probability and try to maximize the log likelihood, which is exactly the same result as maximizing the likelihood because it's monotonic with probability. So we take the log of both sides and we get the likelihood of the nth observation is some constant, just taking log here, minus log sigma, minus the quantity that's in the exponents. And that's for one sample. And then the assumption that you always want to make is that these samples are all independent, so that the probability multiplies and therefore the log likelihoods add. So we're going to try to maximize the sum of the log likelihoods. And now we've converted it to a high school math problem that we know how to solve. We take the derivative of the log likelihood with respect to the parameters that we want to find the maximum of it under. So partial of the log likelihood with respect to mu gives this term. So we differentiate the sum with respect to mu and we get
Shouldn't your pump disappear?
Yes, it should disappear. Thank you. Fortunately, it's equal to zero, so it's not a big problem. But yes, I was wondering what that was as you asked that question. You get two times this, which passes the other two. And taking the derivative with respect to sigma gives us two terms here, one from the log sigma and one from this one. And we get this expression, which should equal zero. Then if you just rearrange terms mentally in your head, you get the answer that here's the results from the previous page. And then taking mu to the other side gives us the value, which gives the stationary point of the log likelihood. And we haven't bothered to check that it's a maximum, but it is. Is that the value you should estimate for the mean parameter is the sample mean, as you said. And the value you should estimate for the variance is the sample variance. But again, the point of going through this exercise is here's the machinery you can use even when you don't know what the answer is going to be at the time. And again, it only is appropriate to use this where you have enough data to swamp any sort of priors. And then for a generalization, we haven't worked through it, but it's straightforward to do the vector version of this. And for vector value data, you find the covariance matrix by the sample covariance. Okay, so that's fitting the kind of simplest thing. Now let's work up to something slightly more complicated. Suppose you have a lot of samples in the plane, and we want to fit a straight line to them. And so again, this what we're going to ultimately want to head toward is suppose you have a lot of video data and you have a parameterized model of a person and how they generate video data. You want to find the set of parameters of your model so that you best explain the observations that you see. But it's the kind of mathematical machinery is just the same as doing something as simple as this, we have a lot of points, you have a parametric model to explain them. What maximizes the, what's the best setting for the parameters given the data? So here's the, so for our toy case, here's how it kind of works out. So our data consists of XY pairs, indexed by N. Our model is that Y is AX plus, okay. We're just assuming a slope that we have to estimate. And then there's a W value, which is zero mean random noise that explains why the data doesn't fall on the line exactly. So again, if we don't have good prior information about what A should be, then we'll use a maximum likelihood method. The probability of the data given a parameter, which is the likelihood term, is going to be how probable is it that the noise process would take you from the line at this position to the data value that you saw. And so if this term exactly equal this term would exactly equal this term, this was the parameter and there's no noise, but there is noise, and so the noise has to jump you as far as the difference between these two values is, and the probabilistic penalty you pay for jumping that distance is e to the minus that is the square root of 2, we're assuming the sigma is wrong in this case. Does everyone see how we got that? And so, we're assuming that the line goes through zero, so it's just a one parameter estimation problem. To find the parameter we're trying to estimate, we want to pick the one which maximizes the probability of all the data. And again, we just maximize the log likelihood, which in this case means maximizing the sum of these quantities in the exponent, where if they're part of this notation, I've introduced a shorthand notation for the absolute value of y minus ax at the end point is going to be dy1a. And so we do the same thing. We take this differentiate with respect to a, set it equal to zero, and it's two lines on the back of a piece of paper to verify that the value of a, which sets that derivative equal to zero, is this quantity here. The sum of all your data points of their x times y values divided by the sum of all data points of their x values squared. Okay, so we've now done a pile of points, we've done a line, but now we finally get to something that's another thing that often happens in perceptual problems is you have some additional hidden variable that you don't know how it should be assigned, and you have to estimate that as well as the parameters you want. So for example, suppose you get this pile of points, and it looks like there ought to be two lines there, and you think there are. So what's the best way to fit two lines to this set of data points? And does someone have, I mean, is there a knee-jerk reaction to what we should do in this case also? Sorry,
mixture.
A mixture of Gaussians?
Sure.
Yeah, you could do that. What did you say?
I'm sorry, sure.
Mixture of lines. I mean, both those intuitions are right. We're gonna have two candidate lines and see who goes with which. Let's see, and then also just before we do this, so what sort of visual perceptual problems are analogous to this one? Just to mention some offhand, it's often the case that if you knew that you're just looking at one rigid thing and it's rotating, you can figure out the structure of the object from the way points move. And that's great, But then suppose you have two things in the field of view. Well, if you knew which one was which point went with which, then you could just do that old problem you had twice and you could figure out what the structure of each one of them was. But you don't know which one goes with which, and so you have the same analogous problem of, if you just knew which point went with which model, you could find the parameters of the model, but we don't know that. So, let's see, just to go on with the slides, here's what we want to do. So we want to have the parameters for two different lines. We want to find slopes A1 and A2. And so here's the dilemma. On the one hand, if someone magically gave you the labeling, so okay, here are the green points, here are the red points. The green points all fit with one line, the red all fit with another. Then we're back to the single line problem twice, and still it's not a problem. Okay, so that we could do. And then on the other hand, if someone magically told us what the two lines were, well, for one thing, we'd be done. But also, we could figure out which point went with which line. You know, that would be straightforward. But we don't have either one. We don't have, you know, if we knew just which one went with which, we'd be done. Or if we knew what the formula for the line were, we'd be done. But we don't have either of them. And so it's the classic chicken and egg problem. And the sort of knee-jerk solution you should have when you hear of a chicken and egg problem is say, well, maybe we could use EM, which is this expectation maximization algorithm. And so I'll go through what that is. But I should mention that EM solves chicken and egg problems in pretty much the same way that evolution solved the original chicken and egg problem, which is to say that you start from something that's neither chickens nor their eggs, and then keep on iterating back and forth until you end up with chickens and eggs. So that's roughly the approach we're going to take. And here's sort of a mathematical view on it. So we do maximal likelihood estimation with hidden or latent variables, as they're called. So we have our data, which is the should be x and y values. X and y values. And we have the parameters that we want to solve for, which in this case are the two line slopes. And then we have these things that are hidden variables, which are often called like assignment variables, indicator variables, that say, okay, I'm either a red point or I'm a green point, or I'm with this square or I'm with that square, whatever, sort of a label. And the catch is that if you knew the parameters, you could find the labels. And if you knew the labels, you could find the parameters. But you don't know either one. So let's proceed with the machinery of maximum likelihood. And then, by the way, the intuitive, just to tell you the secret, the intuitive thing, procedure we're going to follow is, well, we're going to make up some labels. And then, given those made-up labels, we'll estimate what the parameters were, and then we'll re-estimate what the labels were, and keep on going back and forth. So we'll sort of guess at what the assignment of points to lines are, find the lines, and then re-estimate the assignments again. Yes?
And I've never understood that in how you get the different points to diverge. Like if you have like two clusters of points and you're trying to do a cluster of Gaussians, like why don't both clusters end up on the same? Why don't both Gaussians end up on the same place? Like how does it guarantee that you get two Gaussians?
Right. So the quick answer is it doesn't guarantee it. It goes to a local optimum. And then EM is also, I should say, notorious for going to, you know, it's guaranteed to find a local best guess, which is a nice property, but it's sort of also notorious if you give it a bad starting condition to giving you a bad answer. I think this is based on local best fit. So proceeding with the maximum likelihood machinery, we want to find the parameters, the line slopes, which maximize the log likelihood, given those line slopes, the probability of seeing the data you saw. And then the thing is, we can't really write this down because we need those hidden variables to describe the data that we saw. So what you would do then would be to say, well, I'm going to, what I know how to write is this, really this extra variable there, the probability of the data and particular hidden variable. given the line slopes. And I want to marginalize out over the different hidden variable values. So you know, sum over z, and calculate the argmax of this, but this sum inside the log is really complicated and makes the math sort of spoils any nice mathematics that you could, any nice analytic solutions you could get. So that's a problem, and that's sort of the mathematical motivation for the EM approach. We don't know the values of those labels, but the trick is we're going to use the expected value under our current guess for the parameters. So in other words, you guess two line slopes. I say, okay, given those two line slopes, which point belongs with which line with what probability? So that's this probability of z given the data you saw and your current estimate or the old estimate for the parameters of the lines. So the EM trick is to replace that summation with this one. You're weighting by the expected value of your labels under the previous iterations guess for the parameters. And finding these assignments, or these the sort of membership assignments, is called the E step. And then, given that you've found them, you pretend that this is the function that you really want to maximize, and you twiddle with your theta parameter, with your line slopes, for that guess at the assignments, until you find the optimal line slopes or optimal parameters. And this iteration is called the M step. And if this were a semester long class in machine learning, we would go through the math, which uses Jensen's inequality, which proves to you, or shows, that this approach is guaranteed to always maximize the log likelihood of the data, and always make your model more and more probable given the data that you saw. Now, the thing it doesn't do, as you pointed out, it doesn't guarantee a global optimum, but it does guarantee a local optimum, which is always nice. So let's take that general machinery and apply it to this particular problem. So our hidden variables are the label of which, for every data point, which line it belongs to. And we'll introduce notation called the probability that point I belongs to, point N belongs to label I is WI of N. So we need to calculate these. This is the E step. And it's just asking the question, how probable is it that Gaussian noise would jump me from where the model, this particular model says I should be, model I, to the value that I am? And that's this Gaussian probability. And you ask, what's the probability that noise would jump me from model 1 to where I am, and that noise would jump me from model 2 to where I am? And you normalize so that the probabilities add up to 1, and you find how much this point likes either of those two models, how much belongs to it. And then now you can compute this so-called Q function, where you sum over all the data points and take this weighted average of these two. So it's like this is your likelihood function, but it's kind of a soft likelihood function. If we knew for sure which model it belonged to, then it's just saying, find the parameter A, which minimizes this quantity in the exponent of the Gaussian. But you don't know which one it belongs to, so you hedge your bets, and you say, well, it's 0.8 times this optimization problem plus 0.2 times this one, if your point happened to be 80% supposed to belong to this one and 20% belong to that one. And this sort of soft assignment formula then gives you a modified analytic formula for your line slope, which is just what we had before, except in this case it happens to be weighted by the probability that each data point, the sum of all data points, weighted by the probability that each data point belonged to either of the two models. And so you compute this for both of your two models, A sub 1 and A sub 2, to find the M step value, the new slope values for your model. So you bounce back and forth between assigning membership to one of your models and then maximizing the parameters of your model given those membership assignments. So here's those two steps. And if you go to the web, you can get a demo of precisely this problem on Rayer Weiss's webpage. Here's a progression of the EM algorithm on that problem. So you have these are your data points, these here and these here. And these are your initial guesses for the two-line slopes. And with those initial guesses, these are your assignments of points to lines. Now it looks pretty chaotic there, but if you, in this case, even from this starting condition, it converges to the right answer. I don't know how, I guess this is, okay, iteration 1, 2, 3. So iteration 1, at iteration 2, these guys all think they're much more likely to belong to this line than to this one. And these guys up here think they're much more likely to belong to this line than to that one. Now, they don't think they're very likely to belong to that line, but given these two alternatives of either this model or that model, they really favor this model. So at iteration 2, these are your expected values of the hidden labels. And then given these values, you say, well, suppose with these weights, you do your M step and find the best lines, assuming this weighted assignment of the lines to points, and you get these lines. And now you're there, because now the membership assignments are exactly correct, and you have best fit for the lines.
Is there no noise?
In this example, it looks like there's very little noise, but in this example, I don't think there was much noise at all. But in general, of course, there is. So EM is kind of a bread and butter algorithm. And so here are just a couple of examples where you might use it. This is the one I mentioned before, structure for motion with multiple moving objects. It's a problem you know how to solve with a single moving object. And then with multiple ones, you can use EM to solve it, even though you don't know which point goes with which object. Motion estimation confined with perceptual grouping. Again, if you have multiple moving objects, it's often difficult to decide what's moving where. But if you knew which point was with which object, it becomes very simple, and so it's the same problem. Multiple layers. I guess the general theme of all of these is you have multiple processes making many things happen in the image. If you only knew what each data point went with as far as the process, it would be very trivial to solve. And it becomes solvable if you use EM.
Is there a way to, while you're doing that, estimate how many lines you need? Like, if you don't know
often. Right. Yes. I should do a lecture on that. Yes, you can think of that as learning the model. And there are ways of doing that. And I think actually Yaiv has an example on his webpage that addresses that. But basically you want to trade off how well you fit your data with your model versus how complex your model is. You have lots and lots of line models, you just fit the data exactly, but you have a very complicated model. And so there are ways you can trade off those two against each other in a principled way. I'll try to address that in the future lecture. So, yeah.
So initialization pipelines to a
minor set,
so it's a big difference between these EFs.
I guess I don't have any general answer on that. That's sort of the part of the art or the, you know, the sort of the skill that's involved in making a particular thing work is coming up with a creative way to getting that good first guess. I guess the only general procedure to say is to be very careful about it and really, you know, try very hard to make as good a first guess as you can. And also, as you said, multiple restarts is another way to address that problem. So that's sort of a taste of fitting models to data. And of course, we'll do that more later in the class when we actually go ahead and do these things I alluded to of fitting a parameterized model of a human to some video data. But these are the general principles of the maximum likelihood approach. And then now I want to talk a bit about how to modularize joint probability distributions. So the real world is hopelessly complex, and if you have to treat, you have lots and lots of variables you're playing with. If you have to treat all of them together in one joint probability distribution, you just will fail. It's impossible. But there's this kind of field of probabilistic graphical models, which is a way to assemble big, elaborate probability distributions out of little simple pieces that you know how to deal with. And that's kind of the main thing. It's like making a big toy out of little Legos. And because you understand the little pieces, then you can actually solve these problems and address them. So you get the best of both worlds. You get simple pieces that you know how to work with, and when you're all done putting it all together, you get a very complex probabilistic model with lots and lots of variables. So that's the theme and the idea. So the readings. It's funny, I found this paper on the printout. I was getting something else on the printer, and I found this paper on the printout like 2 weeks ago. I thought, wow, this is great. And I read it, and it's a really wonderful paper by Michael Jordan, who's like the god of graphical models, and Yair Weiss, who is another student of my thesis advisor, who's really good. So anyway, this article is really wonderful, and so you should read it, please. Another good source is Kevin Murphy's webpage. So Kevin was a postdoc here for a while. And when he was a graduate student at Berkeley, he kind of made this tutorial on graphical models in BayesNet, which is sort of comprehensive and goes through things really quickly, but it gives you a lot of pointers, and it's a good resource. So, just to introduce it, let's look at another toy example. Suppose we have five variables that all interact. And so, okay, what might this be? Well, some of them might be observed. So, you know, this would correspond to pixel intensities in your video. And then some of them might be unobserved, which would correspond to parameters of your model. And what you want to do is kind of understand this joint probability distribution, how the whole system relates to each other, such that when you're given some observation, you can integrate all the variables you don't care about and just find out about, say, particular parameters of the model. But so the first step you want to do is have a handle on this joint probability. So if you don't use the Tinker Toy approach and you treat this as just a five-dimensional function, then you're limited to what you can do. Suppose what you want to do is find out the value, the mean, say, of variable x1, which might be the position of the hand of the person you're observing. So to do that from this joint probability, you might go the MAP or the MMSE approach. You might say, let me find the value of x1, which gives the maximum over all these values. So in principle, then, you could search over all possible values of every one of your variables and find the one which maximizes probability, and then take the value for x1 that went along with that maximum probability value. So that's the MAP solution for finding x1. And you can imagine in a high dimensional space, that's a lot of searching you have to do. Another approach is to marginalize out all the other variables. and then take the mean or the maximum of the one you're interested in. So marginalizing over x2, x3, x4, x5 gives you the marginal probability on x1, and then if you take the mean from that, that's equivalent to finding the MMSE solution, minimum mean square error solution. And then, strangely enough, sometimes what you do is marginalize over the other variables, and then takes the max of the resulting marginal probability, which is often called something like the max marginal, and sometimes that's useful for convenience. But either of those two is going to be really hard to do if all you have is this big five-dimensional function to work with. And then here's showing that it's hard to do. So if we're going to take the, if we're going to marginalize over the other variables, here's what we're instructed to do. Take the sum over all the states of x2, x3, x4, x5, and add up the joint probability. So that's going to be very hard. But if we assume a special structure for this joint probability, then everything becomes easier. So for the general case, it's very hard. But suppose we have this sort of relationship between the variables, which is that x1, in some sense, causes x2, and x2 causes x3, and x3 causes x4, x4 causes x5, and that also the, this graph indicates that, and also indicates this Markov assumption, that if you know everything there is to know about x3, you don't need to know anything about x2 and x1 to know what's going on with x4. So we'll use that in a second. So this is, let's say that we don't have the most general of all probability distributions. We have something that, where the graphical model looks like this. Then what can you do? Okay, so here we are still, this math holds still for the general case. We're going to use this equation that's joint probability of A and B is just probability of B given A times probability of A. And we can take that rule and apply it to this thing repeatedly to get a kind of chain rule where we can expand this out. So we first treat x1 as A and all the rest of the variables as B. And we, and we write this joint as probability of x1 times probability of all the other variables given x1. Then we'll do the same thing for this guy. And we'll say, well, now x2 is A and all the rest of them are B. And we say this term is equal to probability of x2 given x1 times probability of the rest of them given x1 and x2. Right? And you keep on doing that until you expand this thing out into this chain of conditional probabilities. Now this expression holds in general for any distribution. But really soon we're going to use a Markov assumption to get rid of all these conditional dependencies. So suppose then we go back to this assumption that our joint probability has a particular form. Then we're allowed to simplify that equation and say that the probability of x5 given the values of x1, x2, x3, and x4 is exactly the same as the probability of x5 given x4. In other words, if you know everything about x4, you don't need to know about the ones before. And so now this equation becomes this one, where everything's much simpler and more modular. So what's the big win with that? When we do our summations, if we do it for this general case, we really can't simplify things much. But if we do it for this restricted special case, each one of these summations is going to slide through here past the variables that it doesn't operate on, and it'll stop when it lands on a variable of the summation. And this summation over x2, x3, x4, x5 becomes this very modular set of operations here. In other words, the x5 sum doesn't operate on x, probability of x1, or x2, x1, x3, there's no x5, so it gets here. And so now we sum over x5 here. X4 doesn't operate until it gets to here, and so forth. Is that, so these are obviously elementary operations, but is that clear what we're doing? So the benefit you get from all this is that you get to do these partial sums. And let's see how much it costs to do the summations in the general case versus doing these partial sums like this. So just to be concrete, suppose each one of these variables had 10 possible states. So if you don't reach here, what would it cost you to sum over four of those variables, to marginalize over them? Well, you have to sum over all 10 states here. And for each one of them, you have to sum over the 10 states of this one. And for each one of those, the 10 states of that one. So that becomes 10 to the fourth additions you have to do for the general case. But look what happens for the specialized case. You take a variable x5, you sum over its 10 values, you get some number that's a function of the states of x4. And then you pass it on to here, and you just sum over the 10 possible values of x4, and you get some result that depends on the values of x3, and so on. And so instead of having to do 10 raised to the fourth sums, we just have to do 10 times 4 sums. And obviously that's a huge savings, 40 versus 10,000. When you do this sum for x5, you get a vector that's a function of the 10 states of x4, and you, in some sense, pass this on to this summation here. That vector is, you can think of it as a message, and this sum computes a message and passes it to that one, then you sum over the states of x4, which computes a message, which would be a function of x3, passes it to that one, and so now we make the jump from talking about marginalization over joint probabilities to talking about passing messages from one node to another. And so again, because we have this modular system, these are the instructions for how to let the different pieces of your Lego construction set talk to each other. And it makes the marginalization really simple and really fast. We'll talk about leaf propagation again in a little bit later on, but this is sort of the key observation for what leaf propagation is doing. It's taking a big marginalization sum and distributing it over different parts of this modularized probability description. And it's because of the modularized structure of this joint probability that you can get away with this. But when you can get away with it, it's a huge win. And then it becomes easy to see how to do these sums, and it becomes tractable to do them.
Yeah. Just to clarify, the message size you don't lose with an exponential explosion in message size, right? I was thinking that would be one way that it would.
No, that's the thing. You can see that you're just doing 10,000 additions in a much cleverer way, that where you aggregate terms together such that it only costs you 40 multiplies, 40 adds, whatever. So, I mean, you can work through it. Here we're summing with the 10 states of x5. And we're resulting with a vector that's got dimension 10, because we have to do that for each possible value of x4. And then we take that vector as a function of x4, multiply it by this array, which is a function of x4 and x3, and sum over the possible values of x4. The result of that, so that's like a vector multiplying by a matrix. And the result of that is going to be a vector in the 10 possible different states of x3. And then just do the same thing. So it doesn't explode in this case. So in graphical models, there are these two flavors of graphical models. There's the ones with arrows and the ones without arrows. And typically for vision problems, you often use modularized probability distributions, which are written without arrows and which have this kind of a form, that you'll have a so-called compatibility function relating the states of this one to the states of this one. As a function of the states of these two neighbors, and the joint probability is just a product of all the pairwise joint compatibility functions. That's a sort of a common form. Of course, it can have more general forms. You can have trios that determine these compatibility functions as well. But a very common form is this one, and later on in the class we'll go over how you might learn these compatibility functions. but this diagram still has the markup property that if you know everything about X3, X4 doesn't need to know any more than that. It doesn't also know the values of X1 and X2. Often this is more natural for vision problems because there's no preferred direction in space. There's not a sense where the pixel to the left causes the pixel to the right or vice versa. So this is often more natural. For temporal problems, it's often more natural to have causality where this variable causes this one, which causes this one, and this might be a function of time in that direction. But you can do belief propagation. But both of these models are kind of modular descriptions of the joint causality of those variables, and you can play the same trick with distributing the sums and a marginalization over the different pieces of it for either type of graphical model. So with that as a little introduction, let's jump into a particular graphical model that's often used in vision, and that's a so-called Markov and field. So now we're going to jump from having five variables connected like this to having a whole image worth of variables connected in that way. And so often it might be the case that these variables here are some function of space that you're trying to estimate. So they might be the height in the stereo map, or they might be motion vectors. And these variables here might be local observations that are related to the underlying state that you're trying to estimate. And in general, there's some gigantic joint distribution which relates the observations to the underlying state and describes the prior probability of the underlying state. But again, we're going to simplify our lives and assume that it has this very modular structure, which again will let us solve things much more easily than we otherwise could. So some of the ways that these models are used, lots of times you see Markov bounded fields used where each node in the Markov bounded field corresponds to a pixel in the image. And this is one way you can define a joint probability over the space of images. So here's an original undegraded image, this one. Here's a noisy version of it. And then these are different smooth versions that assume in this Markov bounded field that neighboring pixels like to have the same value as each other. Yet they also like to have the value that they observe to have, modulo some observation noise. And you can then find the states, the underlying states of the image before corruption by noise, which maximize the joint probability of the whole Markov bounded field. So that's one way that they're commonly used, where each node is a pixel. Another way that they're sometimes used is with each node representing a bigger thing. So in some of my own work and other people's work, we have each node represent a patch of the image, or a patch of the thing you're trying to estimate. So that these nodes might represent this part of the picture, and these nodes might represent the shape that creates that scene, so it might be this thing here. And so with this two-dimensional graph, we have this general form for the joint probability of the scene and the image. So we're going to call the observed variables that you see the image, and the things you're trying to estimate, we're going to call it the scene. So again, we have this form that you have the product over all your compatibility functions. So these are product over all neighboring nodes of the compatibility of the state of that node with the state of its neighbor, and the probability of each node of the compatibility of the local scene you can estimate and the local image evidence that's falling on the image there. So if you're able to define the problem in this way, then all you have to do is say, let me find, for a given scene that given image that lands on my detector, he states Y, what are the values of all the states of all the nodes that maximize the story probability? So that's one approach you might take, or you might take the average, take the mean, and which estimate you want to take. But of course, it's not trivial to do that. And in general, if you're going to use Markov-Rendon fields in vision problems, there's sort of two things you have to know. One is, how do I learn the parameters of the Markov-Rendon field? In other words, how do you come up with these, all these functions? And then the second one, which is a little bit easier, it's given a set of those functions, and given a set of observations, how do you infer the hidden variables you're trying to estimate? In other words, given a particular image, how do you infer the shape that created it? So those two different steps have two standard names in the literature. One is called inference, which is given the observation plus the hidden state you're trying to estimate, and the other is called learning, which is how do you come up with the model in the first place? So let's talk about inference first. Here's an outline of what we're going to talk about related to Markov-Rendon fields. There's a whole wealth of ways you can do inference in Markov-Rendon fields. I should say the first thing you might think to try, which is just try out all possible states and see which one is most probable, it's not going to work. This takes too long. It's an NP-hard problem of deciding which state optimizes the function. So there's a whole years and years worth of efforts on coming up with approximate ways to solve these Markov-Rendon fields, which means to find the states which maximize the probability of the joint probability of the observation and the hidden state you're trying to estimate. So this is sort of general stuff that applies to all Markov-Rendon fields. And then we'll talk a little bit about vision applications in Markov-Rendon fields. And then talk about the problem that I'm postponing, which is how do you learn those parameters in the first place? Okay, so first is sort of the classic way of solving Markov-Rendon fields, which is Gibbs sampling and simulated annealing. How many have been exposed to that before? Okay, so Gibbs sampling is this beautiful technique which says you have some, in general, very complicated probability distribution, and you want to have a black box which gives you samples from that distribution. So you have, for example, a joint probability defined over variables x1, x2, x3, x4, x5, and you want to just take random draws from that according to that probability. So I didn't write down actually, but the way to do it, which is very just beautiful that it works, is you fix, say, the first four variables to some value, and then you just do a random sample of that last variable with the assume that the other variables are fixed. So you fix x1, x2, or 3, x4, and draw a sample from probability of x5 given those fixed values. Okay, then you can see what's coming. Then you fix that value and let another one float. And now you have a different four variables clamped. And you let that other one, you take a random draw from the probability of that other one variable given those four clamped ones. And you keep on going. And that's guaranteed in the limit to give you unbiased random draws from the joint probability distribution. But you avoid the problem of sampling from this very complicated joint distribution, and you reduce it down to multiple problems of sampling from a simple one-dimensional distribution with the other variables fixed. And then simulated annealing is an outer loop algorithm that operates with this as an inner loop. Typically in these problems, there may be a so-called temperature parameter, which when this temperature parameter is set to zero, gives you a distribution with only one, where the mean is the maximum value of the joint probability. And so an approach to finding the MAP solution is to keep adjusting this temperature parameter until you find random draws from the thing when the temperature is set to zero, which will be the same as the maximum value of the general distribution.
So let's first see how Gibbs sampling works.
For Gibbs sampling, you assume you have the joint distribution.
Yeah.
So you also need the conditional distribution.
Well, you assume that you know if you have all the variables except one of them fixed, you assume you know how to sample from that. And with the Markov random field, you do know that. So for example, you might have a probability of the surface defined as a Markov random field. And then to draw random samples from that surface, you fix all the values except one pixel. But the probability of that pixel is only going to depend on its nearest neighbors. And so then that's a very simple function to sample from.
So let's look numerically at how you sample from a 1D distribution. So step one is discretize the density.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Suddenly it all came out here. It turned out pretty well there.
So okay, so this is sort of a subroutine of a Gibbs sampler, which is given a one-dimensional distribution, how do you sample from it? So first of all, we're going to live in a discrete world, so we'll discretize any analytic probability density function to a set of histogram bins. And then, does anyone have in their head a good way, given that this is your probabilities function of each of these states, how to randomly draw states according to this distribution? Yeah.
If you integrate FK with the cumulative distribution, take the uniform random variable on 0 and 1, and take the inverse.
Perfect. Yes, and that's exactly what my slides are going to show. Yeah, that's great. So let's do what you described. So you get the cumulative from that. Okay, so what you want to do is draw samples from here weighted by how high the bar is relative to all the other ones. And this is a very beautiful way of doing that. You transform from the density, the probability density at every point, to the cumulative distribution at every point, and which means you take the area under the curve from the left end to where you are, and that's the height of this here. So now the height of each jump relative to the neighboring bin is proportional to how much probability density there was in that bin there. And so when we take samples proportional to how much probability density there was there, that's just equivalent to taking samples according to how much this bar here is higher than its neighbors. And you want it all to sum to one. So if you kind of turn sideways and look at it from this point of view, the part of each bar that's showing relative to its neighbor is directly proportional to the probability that you want to sample it with. And so then if you just take a uniform probability along this axis and sort of project it down here, each bin will get weighted by how probable it is that you want to draw from that bin in your density function. So then the procedure is, you take a uniform distribution, randomly draw with a uniform probability on this axis, and then for each given sample, you see which, project in this direction, see which bin it is that's higher than its neighbor at that value. And that's the value you draw from.
Excuse me, you said eight axis?
No.
Okay.
So if one value is very high relative to the others, it will have a lot of its bar showing here in the cumulative distribution, and it will have a high probability of getting picked when you follow that algorithm. Yes?
Finish your sentence.
That's pretty much the end.
With the Gibbs sampling, in an image, what I'm about to ask, it seems like it would happen, but it seems like it might happen in general. What if your combination of your first four variables, let's say, is impossible? You see what I mean?
Okay, let's see. Right, so that is... so there may be technical details on the Gibbs sampling theorem which would get you out of that situation. In practice, it is a problem sometimes that you get stuck in low probability areas of the joint distribution. Mm-hmm. And it might take you a while to get out from there. But the guarantees are that ultimately you will get out of there and ultimately you'll be drawing from the true joint probability. Mm-hmm. And so the catch is, how long are you willing to wait before the theorem kicks in? You know, so you might be stuck in a low probability area for a long time. Okay, so this is a sort of subroutine that lets us draw a random sample according to the probability of density of a single variable. And then now we just use that multiple times. So here's a cute graphic that a graduate student of mine, Salvio, made. So let's say that this is our joint probability distribution, and instead of having thousands of variables for this example, we're just having two. But we want to run a Gibbs sampler and see, and let it therefore take samples from this joint distribution according to this probability density. So here's how you do it. I don't know if you can see these superscripts, but x, the sample you take for variable x1 at time t plus 1 is you draw from the conditional probability on x1 given all the other values planned. So that might be here. Let's see. Right, okay, so I don't know. Yeah. So here's where you were, say. You clamp all the variables except you allow this B to move on this wire, that you can change the value of x1 according to this now this one-dimensional distribution cutting through the joint in this way. So you take a random sample from here, and it's not very likely to come out here, it'll probably be somewhere in between here, and that's what you get. And now you fix this value in x1 and let your b slide in this axis and again sample from this new one-dimensional distribution made by cutting your joint along this way. So here it's very probable, less probable, less probable. And then we, let's say our sample took us here, then we just repeat and fix that value, let it slide this way according to this one distribution, draw a random sample from the way we saw how to do, and you just keep up that process. And eventually, your Gibbs sampler gives you samples according, you know, it's guaranteed to give you samples according to the underlying 2D or n-dimensional distribution. Too much time on his hands. okay, so then that's a Gibbs sampling. Then there's simulated. Yeah.
So clearly, the first sample that you had is an actual sample, right? That you came
right.
up with it.
Right.
And after some point, the samples really start coming from the distribution.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the point that it starts out?
I think that's the $1,000 question.
To my question, like, you wouldn't get any impossible combination if you chose it.
Right, so the real question is how long do you have to wait? How long do you have to run this algorithm until you know that you're getting samples from the distribution? And so I haven't played with them enough personally to know what the rules of thumb are. You can, I think you want to run tests to, you know, start it several different times and let it run different amounts and see that you're getting samples from the same thing. And you also want to, like, another approach to doing would be to calculate the mean of some variable and see that it's not changing over time. Things like that you'd want to do as a sort of experimental test to see that you're really sampling from the true joint probability. yes, it's absolutely true that if you take your answer too soon, you'll just get some sample from some low probability region you just happen to start from. And another experimental test you want to do would be start from a number of different regions, calculate your answer, and see that they're agreeing. So if you do it from a number of different regions and you don't run long enough, you'll get answers that won't agree, and eventually, if you wait a certain length of time, you'll get answers that really start to agree, and you can be sure that you can feel confident that you're sampling from the true giant. So those are sort of experimental ways to do it. I don't know if theoretical guarantees, other than the infinite time on it, you're not going to be willing to wait for. So you really have to treat it as kind of an empirical question of how many samples for this particular problem do I have to take before I'm really sampling from the true underlying distribution.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you want independent samples,
go ahead.
Independent samples, then probably once you take a sample, then you should wait some more. Or is it better to restart a deep sampler from the beginning? Because if you take the next sample, it's obviously very strong to wait if you have multi-dimensional data.
Oh, you mean for this trying different restarts? Or?
Well, no. So if you want the ID samples from the
I see, right. Well, I don't know. So how long do you have to wait before they become independent of each other?
You can probably work around that by taking all of the values you think you're going to need and then do a uniform sample of all of those values. So you throw them away. And I haven't thought of that correctly, but I think in the same way that that's one way to generate, say, a plus one distribution, that may give you infinite samples from this distribution if you line them up more, because you align them and throw them more.
Right, and then the one cap. So then you have to be sure that your bucket of points is big enough that you.
But you need that anyway, just to say that you've actually calculated the distribution.
Yeah.
So I think the point is that there are two ways to test. Once the distribution converges, and then you have to wait for example, the sample to calculate. Because you have to wait actually much more than just.
Yeah, Mr. Chandler, you're assuming the correlation is given more than if you've chosen the samples. And that would always be there because it's an algorithm, but I think it's a set in order that you can, if you then randomly you shuffle the order in which you took them, I think that term would probably be essentially there.
So clearly we want to have insight from a deep sampling jockey who really had these. I'm unfortunately not that person. But if someone wants to read up about it and report to the class, I'd be happy to sort of experimental tips from Gibbs sample would be useful thing. I'll think about it so we can find that somewhere. Okay. So oftentimes we define these marker random fields with this additional parameter which corresponds to a temperature variable. So it comes, of course, from the physics domain where this really is a temperature variable, and when T equals zero, it really means something physical. But in terms of these probability problems, it often corresponds to a continuation parameter or a knob that adjusts the peakiness of the distribution. And when that knob is set to zero, the distribution is entirely peaky at what corresponds to the maximum value for different settings of the knob. So what you often want to do, if you really want to find the max estimate, in other words, that maximum value of the joint, you'll want to take that parameter and keep on drawing samples from the joint distribution as you adjust the parameter to get the thing more and more peaky, so that the only non-zero probability value occurs at the maximum, at the zero value temperature, which corresponds to the maximum value, the MAP estimate of the joint. So this is what's good about it. It's guaranteed to find a global MAP solution. That's just amazing, right? What's bad about it is it takes forever. You've got a Gibbs sampler as the inner loop. So you have your temperature parameter, run the Gibbs sampler until you are drawing a random sample from it, and then lower the temperature a little bit, run the Gibbs sampler more, and if you do that lowering of the temperature slowly enough, you're guaranteed that you'll be, at the end, drawing samples from the maximum of the global joint. But it really takes forever, and so that's sort of what's bad about it.
You don't mean forever at the end of the sentence, you mean forever.
Yeah, so I sort of haven't paid, this isn't my subfield, but my memory of like the Geeman paper, for example, is they have this scheduling, this theoretical result on how quickly or how slowly you should lower the temperature, and it's just far more slow than you can stand to wait for it. And they find empirically that you get really good results violating that scheduling and going much, reducing the temperature much faster than the scheduling tells them to do it. But anyway, this is a big hammer that takes a long time, but it might be useful in some cases. The Gibbs sampler, I should say, is a different, is, with computers nowadays, it's often quite feasible to run a Gibbs sampler on your problem. You can do Gibbs sampling, of course, on any probability distribution. It doesn't have to be this marker bound field. So there are many cases of distributions where Gibbs sampling is really the fastest and most accurate way to do it. All right, so then we, oftentimes you want to find either the MMSE or the MAP solution. Here's how to find each one using a Gibbs sampler. You can find the mean value by just looking at the values of your variable that come out from the Gibbs sampler and averaging over a long enough time. And so that brings up the issues that you were both talking about as to how long you have to average and how long you have to wait before you start averaging. But that's an approach to give you the MMSE solution. And then the MAP value, you've got to do this simulated annealing. Okay. All right, let me just close with another approach to finding solutions to Markov-Rand fields. And this is sort of a classic one introduced by Bessar in 1986. You condition on all your neighbors, and instead of finding the take a random sample from the resulting distribution, you take the mode, you take the most probable solution given the values you set your neighbors to, and you repeat that. So it's got the same feel and same sort of flavor as Gibbs sampling, but it's a lot simpler. You just take the, fix everybody else, and take the value of your node, which maximizes the resulting conditional probability, and just repeat that for a lot of different nodes. So in this kind of binary problem, so each pixel is a node. The nodes just have two states. There's an idealized edge in here and a lot of random noise added. The parameters of the Markov-Rand field have been fixed, set up ahead of time to favor nodes having the same value as their neighbor. And so if you start from these initial evidence and run the Markov-Rand field using iterative conditional mode, I don't know how many jumps are between these different states, but you can see it does convert to a very reasonable solution. And this is an estimate for the MAP solution for this network. So this is ICM, iterative conditional modes, estimate for what the math value underlying this observation is. And that sounds like a good place to stop. So the exam will be posted right now. Don't talk to other people, please, about it. You can talk with us about it if you have questions. And you have until midnight Thursday to do it. Also, actually, I'll be interested in feedback, whether it's too long, too short. You know, we tried to make it just right. And good luck with it. And just treat it like a homework problem if you want. But see you on Thursday.
Sir, the difference in the ICM and because MAP is just the mode of the posterior, right?
Right.
And you want to mean by that, you see, you try to find the mode here?
You try to find, yeah.
How are you?
So it, it,